Part 4. Necromancy and Psychic Attack. The Church does not deny that with a special permission of God, the souls of the departed may appear to the living, and even manifest things unknown to the latter. But understood as the art or science of evoking the dead, necromancy is held by theologians to be due to the agency of evil spirits. The Catholic Encyclopedia. Necromancy means literally divination by the dead, and one of its principal aims is to discover the future. The dead, no longer bound by the limitations of the mortal physical plane, can see the events of the future and can be compelled to reveal them. Moving on a shadowy plane surrounding the physical one, they can also see the location of buried treasure, and they know the nature of spirits and demons and how best to communicate with them. Opponents of spiritualism sometimes describe it as modern necromancy, but the spiritualists have different aims, and their methods are milk and watery in the extreme compared to the methods of necromancy, which is one of the ugliest and most dangerous of magical operations. It is considered peculiarly dangerous because the nastiness of its procedures stirs up evil currents or attracts evil forces which may fasten on the magician. For 9 days before the ceremony, the necromancer and his assistants prepare for it by surrounding themselves with the aura of death. They dress in musty grave clothes filched from corpses, and these must not be taken off until the operation is finished. When they first put these on, they recite the funeral service over themselves. They abstain from even the mere sight of a woman. They eat dog's flesh and black bread baked without salt or leaven, and they drink unfermented grape juice. The dog is the creature of Hecate, the goddess of ghosts and death and sterility, the terrible and inexorable one, the dweller in the void, who is invoked with averted head because no man can see her and remain sane. The absence of salt is a symbol of putrefaction after death because salt is a preservative. The bread has no leaven, and the grape juice is unfermented to stand for matter without spirit, the physical clay without the spark of life. The bread and the grape juice are also the necromantic equivalents of the bread and wine of communion, unleavened and unfermented as a sacrament of emptiness and despair. Through these preparations, the magician puts himself in touch with death, into a corpse-like state in which he is in rapport with the real corpse he intends to disturb. When everything is ready, he goes to the grave, either between midnight and 1 in the morning, the first hour of the new day, a suitable time for raising the corpse to life, or at sunset, the first hour of the new day in the older tradition. A magic circle is drawn round the grave. The assistants carry torches and burn a mixture of henbane, hemlock, aloes wood, saffron, opium, and mandrake. They open the grave and the coffin, exposing the corpse. The magician touches it 3 times with the magic wand, commanding it to arise. One formula is, "By the virtue of the holy resurrection and the agonies of the damned, I conjure and command thee, spirit of N, deceased, to answer my demands and obey these sacred ceremonies on pain of everlasting torment. Berald, Beroald, Balbin, Gab, Gabor, Agaba, arise, arise, I charge and command thee." In a longer process, involving the body of a suicide, the magician commands the spirit by the mysteries of the deep, the flames of Banal, the power of the east, the silence of the night, and the rites of Hecate, to show itself and reveal why it took its own life, where it is now, and where it will be hereafter. The magician taps the carcass 9 times with the wand and says, "I conjure thee, spirit of end deceased, to answer my questions as thou hast hope for the rest of the blessed and ease of all thy sorrow. By the blood of Jesus which he shed for thee, I conjure and command thee to tell me what I ask." They take the body and arrange it with its head to the east, the direction of the rising sun, and with its arms and legs in the position of the crucified Christ, so that it will rise from the dead. At its right hand, they place a dish containing a little wine, mastic, and sweet oil, which they set alight. The magician conjures the spirit to enter its old body again, and to speak, "By the virtue of the holy resurrection and the bodily posture of the Savior of the world, and on pain of torment and wandering thrice 7 years, which by the force of sacred magic rites I have power to inflict on thee. When this incantation has been repeated 3 times, the spirit returns to its old body, which slowly rises until it stands upright. It answers the magician's questions in a faint, hollow voice. Then the magician rewards the spirit by giving it rest. He destroys its body, burning it or burying it in quicklime, so that it can never again be troubled and called back by sorcery. Written in the time of Nero, the description of a necromantic operation in Lucan's Pharsalia is well in tune with modern magical theory. Sextus Pompey, son of Pompey the Great, is anxious to discover what fate holds in store and decides to consult the dead to be sure of a clear and accurate answer. Quote, "Though it may be well enough for the oracles and prophets who serve the Olympians to give riddling responses, a man who dares consult the dead deserves to be told the truth." Unquote. The ceremony is performed by the witch Erichtho, who had kept on good terms with the infernal powers by squatting in tombs. She had behaved as if she was a corpse, in fact. She also surrounded herself with things redolent of death: gobbets of flesh and bones from children's funeral pyres, grave clothes and pieces of human skin, the nails, tongues, and eyeballs of buried corpses. For the ceremony itself, Erichtho demanded a recent carcass with sound lungs, which would speak audibly and clearly. Older corpses only squeak incoherently. According to occult theory, some of a body's energy remains in it after death, but this energy is gradually dissipated. A recent corpse was found and taken to a dark place screened by yews. Erichtho cut into the corpse's chest and poured into its veins a mixture of warm menstrual blood, the froth of rabid dogs, a lynx's guts, the hump of a corpse-fed hyena, the sloughed skin of a snake, and the leaves of plants on which she had spat. All these were intended to instill a kind of poisonous life into the corpse. Next, she chanted an outlandish incantation, which seemed to mingle the barking of dogs and howling of wolves, the screech of an owl, the roaring of wild beasts and hissing of snakes, the crash of waves on rocks, the murmur of forest trees, and the bellow of thunder. She invoked Styx and the Elysian fields, the euphemistically named kindly ones who torture damned souls, Proserpine and Hecate, Hermes the thrice great who leads men down to hell, the three fates, Charon, who is hell's ferryman, Chaos, and the true ruler of the earth who suffers endless agony below since the gods are so long a dying. At the end of the incantation, a ghost appeared, but at first it obstinately refused to enter the corpse. Erichtho threatened it in the name of all the powers of hell, and gradually the dead body's blood grew warm and began to circulate, the lungs began to work, the muscles to move, and the corpse jumped up and stood erect, pale and tense. It answered the questions which Pompey put to it, and was given its reward to be burned to ashes. In Aleister Crowley's novel Moonchild, an operation of necromancy is begun at sunset. The sorcerers work barefooted to draw up the powers of earth from the volcanic strata below. They cover the ground with nauseous slime and sprinkle it with sulfur. The magic circle is drawn in the sulfur with a forked stick, a sign of the devil, and the grooves filled in with powdered charcoal. The corpse is placed at the center of the circle, its head to the north, the side of shadow. One assistant holds a lighted candle of black wax, the other leads a goat on a leash and carries a sickle. The master sorcerer lights 9 small candles and sets them about the circle. The constant appearance of the number 9 in necromancy may be connected with the old 9 spheres through which the soul rises after death. He impales 4 black cats alive on iron arrows so that their agony will frighten away undesirable spirits, and places them at the 4 cardinal points. The sorcerers intend to evoke a demon from the goat. They will then identify the goat with the corpse so that the demonic power will be transferred into the corpse and will bring its spirit back to life. As the ritual proceeds, the necromancer chanting incantations, the goat bleating, the tortured cat squalling, quote, "It seemed to all of them as though the air grew thick and greasy. that of that slime were bred innumerable creeping things, monsters misshapen, abortions of dead paths of evolution, creatures which had not been found fit to live upon the earth, and so had been cast off by her as excrement, unquote. As the incantations work to their climax, the goat stirs and bounds under the manipulations of the master sorcerer. It can be assumed that these are sexual manipulations. They recognize that the demon is present and stab the goat to the heart. The reeking blood spurts over them, its smell mingling with the stench of sweat and the odor of the decomposing corpse. The art sorcerer begins his final conjuration. They hack off the goat's head, slash a gaping cavity in the belly of the corpse, and thrust the head of the goat into it. Other parts of the goat are pushed into the corpse's mouth. This is the identification of corpse and goat. Suddenly, one of the assistants flings himself onto the two carcasses, tearing them with his teeth and lapping the blood. He is the weakest of the group, and it is through his mouth that the dead man's spirit, now demon-inspired, will speak. He sits up, his face beaming with delight, and answers their questions rapidly and commandingly. In some cases, the dead are summoned to attack a person the magician wishes to harm or master. A Greco-Egyptian text gives the following method of compelling a woman to submit to the magician. He makes a wax doll to represent the woman, and pierces it with 13 needles through the brain, eyes, ears, mouth, hands, feet, belly, anus, and genitals. At sunset, he places the doll on the grave of someone who died young or by violence. Then he conjures the corpse in the grave by Persephone, Ereshkigal, the Sumerian queen of the underworld, Adonis, Hermes, Thoth, and Anubis, the jackal-headed Egyptian god of the dead, by the gods of the underworld and all the legions of the dead untimely snatched from life, and commands it to rise up and stalk through the streets, to go to the woman's house and bring her to him and obsess her. Quote, "And awaken at my behest, whoever you may be, whether male or female. Betake yourself to that place and that street and that house, and bring her hither and bind her. Bring N.N. hither, daughter of N.N. Let her sleep with none other, let her have no pleasurable intercourse with any other man, save with me alone. Let N.N. neither drink nor eat, nor love, nor be strong nor well, let her have no sleep except with me." Unquote. This process amounts to a rape by means of a zombie, one of the living dead, a corpse which the magician has animated and which is subject to his will. Alternatively, another person can be attacked by enlisting a demonic power. Diane Fortune described the methods and symptoms of psychic attack in her book Psychic Self-Defense. She herself was first drawn to occultism by experiencing an attack of this kind, which shattered her health for a long period. To evoke a demonic force against an enemy, the magician performs a ceremony of Mars, the planet of violence and destruction. He drapes the room in scarlet, wears a scarlet robe, and uses instruments of iron with a naked sword as his magic wand. He lights 5 torches, because Gebura, the sphere of Mars, is the 5th sphera. He wears a red ruby and the astrological symbol of Mars engraved on a pentagon of steel. He invokes the archdevil of the 5th infernal habitation, Asmodeus, the demonic force corresponding to Gebura. The magician offers himself as the channel through which this force can manifest itself. To direct it at the victim, a link is needed, a lock of the victim's hair, a nail paring, or something he has often worn or handled. Failing this, the magician can create an artificial link by identifying something in his possession with the victim. For instance, he might formally baptize an animal with the victim's name, and then torture and kill it. Or he may concentrate his hatred on some object which is then left in the victim's house or buried where he will step over it. Concentration is essential. Occultists believe that the magician's will can be turned on other people like a ray or a beam. If he is projecting hatred or cruelty, evil spirits will be attracted by the current of force and will join in the operation. One way of killing an enemy by concentration is called the Black Fast. Mabel Brigg, executed at York in 1538, was said to have confessed to killing a man by abstaining from meat, milk, and all dairy foods, meanwhile concentrating on the victim's death. A modern example of magical concentration occurred in Germany in 1938, when General von Fritsch was tried on false charges faked by the Gestapo. Himmler, the Gestapo chief, was anxious about the outcome of the trial and assembled 12 SS officers, the number of a coven, in a room near the court. He made them sit in a circle and concentrate their minds so as to control the proceedings. But von Fritsch was cleared despite their efforts. The same method was turned against the Germans 2 years later, when it is said the English witches prevented the invasion of England by directing at Hitler's brain the thought that he could not cross the Channel. Another way of launching a psychic attack is through an artificial elemental. Occultists say that elementals, the minor and brutish spirits of fire, air, earth, and water, exist in nature, but that it is also possible to make an artificial one with a temporary lease on life. The magician forms in his mind a clear picture of the creature he intends to create. By concentrated imagination and willpower, and by feeding into the mental picture his own violent emotional forces, his hatred, cruelty, or lust, he can endow the creature with life and send it out to attack an enemy. It may appear in animal form, as a toad or a snake or a wolf, perhaps, or as something which is part human and part animal. It will not be visible to ordinary sight, but the person attacked by it will see it, and so will anyone who is clairvoyant. The symptoms of a successful psychic attack are said to include extreme fear, anxiety and mental distress, bruises on the body, sometimes in the form of a goat's hoof or an ace of clubs, broad smears of slime, sometimes with footprints in them, the smell of decomposing flesh, poltergeist phenomena, and inexplicable outbreaks of fire, and a curious and sinister sound called the astral bell, which may vary from a clear bell-like note to a faint click. The 17th century demonologist Francesco Maria Guazzo, a friar who frequently acted as advisor to the judges in witch trials, included among symptoms of bewitchment slow wasting and emaciation of the body with intense lassitude of mind, convulsions, tearing pains near the heart, heavy pulse, spasms of the neck or stomach, sexual impotence, feelings of intense heat or cold in the stomach, sweating in cold weather, and gummy eyelids. In 1746, John Wesley, preaching in Cornwall, was told by a woman that his sermon had given her relief from a spell cast on her 7 years before, which had caused her fear and horror of mind, and also bodily agony. She felt as if her flesh was being torn by red-hot pinchers. In 1878, at Salem, Massachusetts, a legal action was brought by Lucretia Brown, a follower of Mrs. Eddy in the early days of the Christian Science movement, against Daniel Spofford, another of Mrs. Eddy's followers. The allegation was that by projecting malicious animal magnetism against her, Spofford had caused her mental pain and suffering, severe spinal pains, and neuralgia. Mrs. Eddy, who was herself inclined to claim that her enemies directed malicious psychic currents against her, gave evidence for the plaintiff, but the court dismissed the action. Occultists say that symptoms associated with psychic attack can also be caused by malevolent spirits in cases where something has gone wrong in a magical operation. Evil beings may show themselves in appalling nightmares or in noises, pools of slime or blood, moving balls of light, and disgusting stenches. Eliphar Levi said that on some occasions, after performing occult experiments, he was woken in the night by the sensation of a hand trying to strangle him. His books and papers were disturbed and thrown about, the timbers of the building creaked ominously, and he heard heavy blows on the ceiling. Diane Fortune mentions the case of a man who used a magic square from the sacred magic of Abramelin, but was unable to control the force he had unleashed. He began to suffer from terror at night, especially at the sight of the new moon. When at last he saw the creature which was obsessing him, it had a beard, long flowing hair, and closed eyes. One night a red snake uncoiled itself from under his bed, and to get away from it, he jumped out of the bedroom window 10 feet from the ground. Next time he saw the being, its hair had changed into snakes. Later, a great red obelisk crashed through the bedroom wall, smashing mirrors and windows. All these experiences were hallucinations. But he lived in real terror for months until he was rescued by the help of another occultist. Similarly, the occultist who explores the astral plane runs the risk of failing to bring his astral self back into his physical body. The astral body may then wander away out of his control and may be attacked or obsessed, causing nightmares, hysteria, fainting fits, headaches, in extreme cases, even paralysis or insanity. These symptoms will wear off in time, but may still cause permanent damage in the form of inability to concentrate, follow an argument, keep a promise, or persist in any given course of action, all of which recalls Guazzo's lassitude of mind.